A sport to the finest in folk music. Old, new, and everything in between. The wonderful, the wild, and the weird.
Walk quietly by, he won't bother you. He's a busy man, he's got things to do.
It's all here Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m. Folk Everything with Hugh on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston.
It's 11 p.m. here in the city of Kingston on a Wednesday night, and I hope you are ready to be gay and do crime with Mark Terra and Rainbow Country right here, right now on CFRC.
The following program is an all-language show which includes open discussions on topics related to the LGBTQ plus community and beyond, including, but not limited to, mature subject matter such as sex and sexuality, personal experiences, and more. We aim to create a respectful and inclusive space for all. Listener discretion is advised. The views and opinions expressed are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the producers and this outlet. Stay tuned for thought-provoking conversations and so much more.
Sean Baker slid into my DMs. There's no other way to say it. He sent me a message. A week prior, I had watched The Florida Project for the first time. And I love that film. And I love the way that it handled a sex work component to the film. And so it was very surreal to get a message from the director so soon after watching his work.
Today on Rainbow Country, a spotlight on two award-winning Canadian films, queer film Bloodlines and Modern Horror. That and more next. So stay tuned. The Gay Talk Radio right here on Rainbow Country.
Hi, this is Emily Saliers from Indigo Girls.
Hey everyone, this is Chris Harder, porn star, burlesque performer, and the creator of Porn to Be a Star. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Well, hello, and welcome to Rainbow Country. As I like to call it, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. As always, I'm your tour guide through Rainbow Country. I'm producer and host, Mark Tara. Well, thanks to you tuning in, streaming, downloading, but ultimately listening. Together, we continue to build Rainbow Country into an award-winning nationally syndicated gay radio show, as well as being a number one LGBT podcast. So, today, a spotlight on two award-winning Canadian films that I covered during the 50th edition of the Toronto International Film Festival in 2025. Modern Horror, an award-winning film that tells the journey of Canadian sex workers. And Bloodlines, an award-winning film that explores queer Indigenous love, family reconciliation, all taking place in a contemporary Métis village. In Hour 2, music from LGBT artists, independent artists, voices that we've come to know and love in classic disco, classic 80s, classic house. All that lies ahead as we start this journey through Rainbow Country. Our first stop, the Rainbow Country Bookstore. Today, award-winning journalist and author Rhea Rollman reads from her 2023 Canadian history book, A Queer History of Newfoundland. By the way, on Amazon.ca, A Queer History of Newfoundland was a number one bestseller in local Canadian history.
When high school teacher Anne Escott took her recess break that pivotal day in May 1974, it was a routine morning. Escott worked at Bishop's College, where she taught physical education and biology. Midway through the morning, she joined other teachers in the staff room for recess. The women preparing lunch for the students turned on the radio to a popular phone-in radio program that aired daily on CJON. None of this was unusual, but what Escott heard next caused her jaw to drop. The host of the program was interviewing a man named Norman Hay, who was a member of Gay Ottawa. Hay was visiting St. John's and had reached out to CJON offering to talk about his work with Gay Ottawa. They invited him in and put him on the air. When Escott tuned in, Hay was chatting about his work and said he was perplexed as to why he could find none, she explained to me. She remembers the broadcast quite vividly. I thought he was incredibly brave because some of the people phoning in were just horrible. Others were quite supportive. I was just elated. I couldn't believe someone was actually doing this. As soon as she could, Escott slipped off to find a telephone. She phoned her girlfriend at the time, Sandy Pottle. I said, there's someone on the radio and they want to get a group together. Has anybody gotten his information? This was long before the internet, but the informal queer phone tree was already in operation. Pottle replied that another friend had just reached out and gotten his contact info. Apparently, at least a dozen gay people had phoned CJON looking for his contacts. There was going to be a meeting with him the following night. It was so wonderful, recalled Escott, of the day she heard Hay on the radio. It's hard to explain. It was wonderful, but terrifying. It was a mix of emotions. It was like, oh my God, there are other people out there who are doing this and on the radio, and maybe we actually can do something and not be murdered or killed. That morning's program set off a powerful buzz in the city's still largely underground queer community. Those who heard it discussed the remarkable interview and decided that if mainlanders could get on the radio and openly ask, where are all the Newfoundland gays, it was time for the Newfoundland gays to get organized. Joey Shulman was born in St. John's and grew up there in the 1950s. He was living in Toronto when the bathhouse raids took place in 1981 and was present in one of the bathhouses that was raided. He was arrested. It was for him one of the moments which reminded him how quickly societal tolerance can shift. It was a lesson he'd initially gleaned from reading about Oscar Wilde, who one moment was celebrated by British society and the next shunned and imprisoned. Shulman's own experience in the bathhouse raids underscored a similar theme. We need to learn from our past, he says. No matter how uncomfortable we get as gay people, there are always people like Hitler, people like McCarthy in the 1950s US, people like the RCMP fruit machine, the bathhouse raids. The bathhouse raids happened at a time when we felt so liberated. We were out in downtown Toronto. We were living in entire apartment buildings downtown. We were fabulous. We were exploding. We were just like Mary Tyler Moore, throwing our hats in the air. And then suddenly the police just clamped down. It's important for younger people to know that this was a real attempt to stop us from finding and having and sharing love, Shulman said. And that shouldn't be allowed. People came out of that defiant. It was our Stonewall moment. We took to the streets and we won all those rights that ensued. The stigma faced by those diagnosed with HIV was immense. Trudy Parsons recalled one community around the bay that she visited with activists Yet Men and Upward to put off a workshop on a weekend. As they set up their materials and locals started filtering in, Parsons detected a strange atmosphere in the room. They were acting weird. I didn't know what was going on. They wouldn't make eye contact with me. Usually people will nod at you or speak or stare at you because they're mad, but they looked like they were holding a lot of guilt and shame, and I couldn't figure out why. They weren't even sitting with each other. They were all sitting with their backs to each other or turned away. I was like, what the fuck is going on? Then a fisherman guy comes in and he's in his gear and he stomps on in, and I thought, oh great, he's going to give me a hard time, because he came in all aggressive. So we changed the order of speaking and I got up right away and I said, there's something going on here. What is it? You guys look like you're in a lot of pain. Then this woman turns around to the guy in the fisherman clothing and says, are we going to tell her? And he goes, yep. Then he says, we're ashamed. And I was like, okay, well, we're here to talk about difficult things. That was my mantra. We can talk about difficult things. So they talked about a gentleman that had come home with AIDS and they had crucified him. They just crucified him. The whole town. I can't remember the stuff that they did, but it was shocking. Absolutely shocking. They just did everything that they could to make the rest of his life as uncomfortable as possible, like throwing rocks at his house in the middle of the night and all kinds of really weird, fucked up things. And they were embarrassed about that. They were very brave in telling it, though. I couldn't believe they were sitting there and telling it. They were so brave. And they were committed to never behaving that way again. Like they were big grown men crying to break their hearts over their shitty behavior. It was something else. And it was more than just HIV. It was about homophobia, and it was about a man being considered what they said was sissy. It was all of that, too.
In the 60s, before the internet, to find each other, queer people needed to actually get together in real space and real time. Since most places didn't tolerate our kind, depending on where you were, your options could be limited. Large cities might have a few specialized commercial spaces, but in the absence of those, it was basically public washrooms, parks, or house parties. They all had their downsides. Commercial spaces required you to spend money, and that's one of the reasons why they were mostly for men. Even in places as big as Toronto, there was seldom more than one lesbian bar at a time. Lesbians earned about 60% of the male wage and probably had more dependents. The economy just wasn't there. The old adage was, gay men go to restaurants, lesbians hold potlucks. Washrooms and parks were also pretty much boys only and could be dangerous. Plus, parks in the Canadian winter, not so good. You could freeze your willy off. House parties, you needed to know somebody, or know somebody who knew somebody, and so on, and be invited. In terms of commercial life, Montreal had led the pack, developing a sin city reputation during Prohibition in the U.S. in the 1930s. And where there's sin, there's always a place for us. Toronto the Good and Vancouver took a bit longer, but in 1974, Toronto had enough anonymity and a critical mass to produce a small commercial scene. At first, it was mostly straight bars where we were tolerated in a corner as long as we behaved. Next came a few straight-owned venues that served gay clientele. By the mid-70s, a new class of gay entrepreneurs emerged and started to open up on Church Street where rents were cheaper. But not everybody lived in Toronto or Montreal. In smaller centers, where businesses couldn't meet community needs, the lesbian and gay liberation movement of the 70s came up with a new model. Defy economics and do it for ourselves. We might not have a lot of capital, but we did have free labor. For example, the Lesbian Organization of Toronto established a non-profit community center in a ramshackle old Victorian house in 1977. It held dances and brunches and drop-ins and provided meeting spaces and a coffee house and hosted a phone line for a whole generation of women. LOOT, as it was known, was following a strategy already developed elsewhere. In Saskatoon, the Zodiac Friendship Society opened its community center in 1973. Edmonton and Calgary soon followed suit. HALO, the Homophile Association of London, Ontario, started in 1974, and the Halifax Gay Alliance for Equality first began running dances in the Turret in 76 and later turned that into a community center. By the end of the decade, there was a network of lesbian and gay groups providing community spaces in dozens of medium-sized centers across Canada, volunteer-run and community-controlled. This is Tim McCaskill, a gay liberation dinosaur from another planet and author of Queer Progress.
Up next, the award-winning Canadian queer film, Bloodlines.
Hi, I'm Saida Garrett, co-writer of Michael Jackson's Man in the Mirror, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mr. Mark Tara.
TIFF actually stands for Toronto is f***ing fantastic.
Gail Maurice. Hello, hi, how are you?
I'm doing well, and yourself?
I am good. I am good. I have to say thank you for returning to Rainbow Country, because you and I met in person during TIFF in 2022 to talk about your then film, a great film, Rosie.
Okay. Yeah.
So we talked about that. That's when you and I first met, and we're here again today to talk about your current film, Bloodlines. Thank you for being here and to talk to me about this. Mm-hmm. This film, Bloodlines. Mm-hmm. Talk to me essentially about the story that you're telling in Bloodlines.
So Bloodlines has been with me for a long time. I started it 20 years ago, and the seed of it began in Regina in a lesbian bar. And I was shooting a film. I can't remember which one it was. And I had a night off. So I went to this bar. And then later on that night, I was lying in bed, and I thought, what if I brought one of those beautiful indigenous woman home, and what if I fell in love? And so that's where the kernel of the initial story began. And 20 years later, this version of Bloodlines is about two women who fall in love. And it's one of the main characters, Beatrice, has an antagonistic relationship with her mother, who abandoned her as a child, and she is dealing
and
with...
And you play the mother?
I play the mother, only because our casting director, Melanie Braid, did an amazing job casting authentically queer leads. And also we wanted Northern Michif speaking actors, and we couldn't find any to play my character who could ad lib with the main, the three, we call them lovingly the granny gang, because my character has to ad lib with them. And so they have to understand each other. So I brought three of these actors from my village, because there's only five villages in the world that speak my dialect of Michif, which is the Métis language. It's a mixture of Cree and French. And so the story is about two women who fall in love, and also about family, family bonds, and what makes us who we are. Is it the blood that flows through our veins, or is it the culture we were raised in? Mm.
They often say, write what you know. Write what you know. So is this story that you're telling, is this a personal story that maybe you've lived, or you've heard from friends, or is this something that is just fiction?
I think the way I write is I write from personal experience. I think that's the most powerful way for the way I write. Because there's a lot of truth in my stories. So yes, there's some moments in my story that are part of my life. Yes, I wish I could tell you more, but if I do, it's going to give away.
Exactly, and yeah. We don't want that.
Yeah.
So you just mentioned this. You just mentioned the name, the Granny Gang. Mm-hmm. I loved these three characters. So much fun. What's the origin story of having these three characters in this film? Was this always the plan to have them be part of the film, or did this evolve over time?
It evolved in this iteration of the story. Initially, when the story began, it was just focusing on, it was set in the city. It was very, very dark. There was there's no aspect of Beatrice, the main character, that you're left liking. So in this story, the granny gang is basically like aunties, you know, the auntie movement. So they're like aunties, and aunties can tell you anything. They can say, hey, stop that, smarten up. You know, they can you know, slap you around, not physically, but with their words to get you to, you know, think straight, or not straight. I always say there's no straight, it's always a little windy, but yeah, but just to make you think before you I guess make mistakes. So to me, the granny gang, they have words of wisdom. They tell you like it is, but also they're funny, you know? Yeah.
They are. They're great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so this movie, Bloodlines, there's a major plot twist in mm-hmm. this film. And the audience has to see this film mm-hmm. to appreciate this plot twist. But because of this twist, when you were originally making this film and you know, seeking funding or backers or what have you, mm-hmm. did you get any pushback because of the plot twist?
I didn't. I got pushback at one point because it was a lesbian love story. And when I got that pushback, I don't want to say which funding body gave me the feedback, but I didn't get funding that year. And I called them and they said, why does it have to be a story about two lesbians? Why can't it be just the story about the mother and daughter? And they said, nobody's read the script. For all we know, it could be the most beautiful script ever. So they read the synopsis and, you know, the budget. And that was what the decision was based on. And when I was told, why does it have to be a lesbian love story? I was so disillusioned, so crushed, so in disbelief, so fucking angry that a gatekeeper was doing the, like, I at that point I didn't see how I could make a film in this country if there were gatekeepers like that. So I almost quit the industry because I was so I was just disillusioned. I didn't know how I could ever make a film if that was the type of person that was going to be, you know, allowing me to make a film or not. So I quit film. I didn't do anything, I think, for about 2-3 years. And then one day, or maybe 2 years, and then one day I said, fuck it, I'm not going to let them, sorry if I'm swearing. I said, fuck it, I'm not going to let, you know, them control me or stop me from telling my story. So I locked myself in the closet, literally at my partner Melanie Bray's mom's house. Her dad had a closet that he made into a little office. So I locked myself up there for 3 days and I wrote Rosie the Short, that became Rosie the Feature, that became a TIFF Top 10 in 2022. And from there, I went back to Bloodlines and I said, damn it, I'm going to do this again. And the story is not going to leave my body. And I went back for funding. And because Rosie was a hit, they funded it.
Wow. That's quite the story. That's quite the journey.
Yeah.
So when you look back on that journey, what do you take away from that?
That person had since been fired, had gatekeeper. But my takeaway from that is never to give up and never to allow anybody to stomp on who you are, who your spirit is. And never allow anybody to deny your story, you know, and deny your truth, and to make you feel as if being queer should not be spoken about or filmed or shown to the world, you know, like that's my takeaway. It's, I think, that we're beautiful. I'm beautiful. Our stories are beautiful. Our stories are unique, and every one of us should be celebrated.
Well said. Well said. So a lesbian romance wrapped up in a celebration of Métis culture. You are one of, I believe, 1,130 people in the world that speak the Michif language.
Mm-hmm.
For you, using your talents, your platform, your filmmaking skills to bring this language to an audience, what does that mean for you personally to be able to do that on such a big, in such a big way, to keep this language going?
When I found out there was only that many speakers in the world, and I found out through the National Film Board, they're the ones that says there's only 1,130 Michif speakers, and that's Michif speakers. The dialect that I speak, Northern Michif, is far fewer. Like I said, there's only five villages in Canada, in the world, that actually speak my dialect of Michif. And for me, having my language in my films is just a way to honor my ancestors, honor my grandmother, honor, you know, the people I come from. It's my language is my culture. My language is my life. In when I speak Michif, if I talk like that, you know, there's 99.9% of the world would never understand me. So I have to put my language in my film so that people can hear it and hear the sound and hear the beauty. When we say tree, mitus, it's not just a tree. It's like, it's a living thing. Everything is living, and my ancestors touched that tree, and it has a story. So my language creates a beauty in the world through the spoken word. It invokes like history, you know. So when I speak my language, my ancestors are talking through me.
Mm. So this movie features a lot of music,
mm-hmm.
including a one Dolly Parton. And I think like her song is played, especially when the granny gang is around,
mm-hmm.
in their car.
Well, the cassette player is stuck because it's so old. So it always comes on. At one point, I wanted one of the characters, I wanted Beatrice to say, you better get that cassette player fixed. But then I thought, nah, I just let it be.
So why Dolly Parton then?
Oh my gosh, she's so iconic. And it just, her voice, and we all love Dolly Parton. And the granny gang loves Dolly Parton. And she's just like, she symbolizes a lot, you know? When I grew up, I grew up without television. Not that I'm ancient, but it's just the way it is in Northern Saskatchewan. We had one radio station, and we would hear Dolly Parton on the radio, you know? So she's a cultural icon.
Mm-hmm. So here is my second to last question for you, and it's simply this. What do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen Bloodlines?
I hope that they come away with, I guess, wanting to know more about Métis culture, wanting to know more, or I guess I would love them to walk away going, wow, because there's so many Canadians that I've met on my time here on Earth that don't even know what being Métis is, or don't even know what Métis is, and they're Canadians. So I hope they walk away with an understanding. But not only that, people were asking about, you know, about the queer representation in the story, but When I came out, my grandma accepted me. Nothing. It wasn't even a thing for anybody. So that's, it's not even a thing in bloodlines. It simply is, you know, being queer for these two women is simply who they are. And there's, I wanted to show, that it's not a thing, you know, it just is. They're beautiful and accepted.
So here's my last question, and it's essentially three really quick questions.
Okay.
One word answers, essentially.
Okay.
So are you ready for these three quick questions? Okay, first one. Red or white?
Red.
Day or night?
Ooh, that's a tough one because I love the moon, but I also love the sun. Day.
So this next one, I ask with all due respect. So please take it in that vein.
What the hell is it? Oh my God.
Masturbator or not?
Masturbator. Big time.
And that is from your film.
It is.
I laughed so hard when that was said. In your film.
Yes.
By the Granny Gang.
Yeah.
Well done to you.
Yeah, thank you.
Gail Maurice, thank you for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much. And see you at TIFF.
Realize what TIFF actually stands for. Toronto is f***ing fantastic.
When I return, the award-winning film, Modern Horror.
Hi, I'm comic artist and author Phil Jimenez, and you're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Hi, I'm Jamie B. of TGCD Style Toronto, and I'm a professional feminization makeup artist and stylist providing male-to-female transformations and mentoring to those who identify as a cross-dresser or a trans woman. I first heard of Rainbow Country and Mark Tara in trying to find a radio station that specifically caters to the LGBT community, and I'm so grateful I found this station. It's crucial having a platform like Rainbow Country that welcomes all aspects of the queer community, including allies like myself and what I do. It casts a spotlight on specific needs and interests of human beings, ensuring that people from all walks of life are being validated. It's a real privilege to be able to work with cross-dressers and trans women by helping them align themselves with their feminine energy through the glorious feminization process. So, I want to thank Rainbow Country and Mark Tara for providing this platform for all of us.
So, as you may know, Rainbow Country is an award-winning gay radio show that's heard on broadcast radio, streaming, as well as a podcast. The broadcast outlets that carry Rainbow Country are listener-supported. They rely on donations to help keep the lights on and the airwaves broadcasting. So if you think what I'm doing here on Rainbow Country is worthwhile, I hope you'll consider making a donation to this very outlet you are tuned to. If you happen to be listening to the podcast version of Rainbow Country, I hope you'll consider making a donation to an outlet that does carry this little gay show. How can you do that? Well, simple. Simply head over to marktara.ca, where everything is connected, and hit the donations banner. That's where you'll find all the outlets that broadcast Rainbow Country, a little gay radio show working to give voice to the LGBT community and beyond. Have your voice, have your support, especially for independent queer radio, heard.
phone rings. I get a message from the mayor. He's going to call me back the next day. I get the call and he said, if you'd accept, we'd like to honor you with the key to the city. There was an event later that year in May. Just a key, right? Like, key to what? A decent job, a good singing career. It's really a metaphor, but it's history. So a reporter wants to talk to me and says, so it's key, right? Like, what's the big deal? He says, well, not everybody gets the key. So I looked it up, and I guess it is kind of a big deal.
The date, May 17th, 2018, when trans activist Susan Gapka made history by becoming the first trans woman to be presented with the key to the city of Toronto. By the way, past recipients include Rush and the Raptors.
Hi, this is Mark Gain.
And Martha Johnson of Martha and the Muffins.
And we just wanted to let you know that we have a new album out called Marthology In and Outtakes, which we hope you'll give a listen to. You're listening to Rainbow Country.
With Mark Tara.
My name is Andrea Warehan. I'm a writer and performer, and I'm also a sex worker. Books, movies, and every syndicated crime drama imaginable, sex workers are typically portrayed as victims or villains. Shame and stigma can silence us. It's high time we told our own damn stories. Here's mine.
Nicole Bazine, hello. Hi, how are you?
I'm well, Mark. Thank you so much for having us.
Andrea Warehan, hello. How are you?
Hello, I'm great. How are you?
I am well. I am better now that I'm speaking to the two of you, especially about your new Canadian feature film, a documentary called Modern Whore. Modern Whore. That is the title. Andrea, let's start with yourself. You are a producer. You co-wrote the screenplay. You star in this documentary, in this film. It is based on your memoir, I believe your 2017 memoir. Talk to me essentially about the story that you're telling in this documentary, Modern Whore.
Well, the Modern Whore documentary spans a sex work career that's now basically 15 years long. I started escorting in my early 20s and quit and then got another job. I got lots of other jobs in the interim, then went into stripping, where I am still currently employed as an artist who is trying to make a living as an artist. I am also a stripper. The documentary is based on the book Modern Whore that I co-created with Nicole that looks at the sort of wide breadth of those experiences. And what we're able to do with the documentary is bring it to life in a way that goes beyond my personal experience in the industry and incorporates the perspectives of other sex workers and also the people in my life who know about my sex work and love me, like my mom and my partner, and I also interview one of my customers.
Mm. Nicole, you are a producer. You co-wrote the screenplay. Talk to me essentially about the evolution of Modern Whore, going from a memoir to a short film, now a feature-length documentary. Talk to me about this evolution and how this all came about, because the two of you have been like a dynamic duo for a while now.
Thank you for calling us a dynamic duo. I think that's definitely how we liked to see ourselves.
Or some modern whores. One or the other.
Yes. Well, I mean, yeah. We met actually in 2011, Andrea and I. So we've been longtime friends, longtime, like, creative co-conspirators with everything we wanted to achieve together. You know, when we set out to create some sort of artwork that would capture Andrea's sex work experiences and combine her writing with my visuals, you know, we landed on a book first that was a collection of Andrea's stories paired with my photography, and our notion with that was that it was going to be Playboy if it were run by the bunnies, complete with a centerfold. So we did that first, and I think, you know, just from that very, that start, we were always kind of playing with the notion of like what a book looks like. This is going to be an untraditional multimedia book experience. And so it felt like a natural progression to kind of also expand into film. And I am a film director. Andrea is not only a writer, she's also a performer. And so we always had these kind of cinematic dreams as we were thinking about the kind of things we would like to make. And so we started out in the short form, making a few short films together. And I would say we were always building to some sort of feature-length project that could tell Andrea's story in a more fulsome way, have more time to kind of show some of the funny experiences, some of the more challenging and darker experiences, and actually have time to get into the nuances of that. So yeah, we're really excited to have built towards this full-length feature film. I think Andrea's performance is like a tour de force in this. I'm so proud and excited for audiences to see it. And for me to craft the visuals and bring the book to life has been incredible. And I think we kind of try to have a unique aesthetic that speaks to the way that we want this story to be experienced.
Andrea, this film, this documentary, it features live action, it features animation. It's also very funny at times. There's a lot of nudity in it as well, but it's also, I think, educational. Because at one point, the documentary, this film, talks about, and something I've never heard of before, but sex reviews. Talk to me about sex reviews, and what are they?
Wow, it's a whole world. So they're sort of formally known as escort review boards and escort review board culture, where the clientele of sex workers, not all of them, but a good chunk, hang out on these online platforms called escort review boards, and they review the sex workers that they've seen and that they've paid to have sex with. And you know, it's always a sort of like rite of passage for every sex worker to discover a review written about their sexual performance on one of these boards. It's deeply uncomfortable, often completely fabricated and untrue. However, you know, as the sex workers in the film talk about, sometimes these reviews can launch sex work careers, and sometimes they can be used as bait to coerce sex workers in the moment. And so it's quite the world, and something that we do in the book that we also do in the movie is, you know, we publish these reviews that were written about me, and then I get to respond to those reviews. And I get to write my review about that person in particular because I remember these appointments. And so, yeah, we dramatize that in the film, and it's really funny. But it is kind of a disturbing underbelly that a lot of people don't know about.
Have they always been around, these review websites, essentially?
I mean, I guess probably for as long as the internet's been around, there's been men talking about women's bodies on the internet.
So, Nicole, the two of you are award-winning creatives in your own right. You won the Audience Award at both the Calgary Underground Film Festival and the Chicago Critics Film Festival in 2023 for the short film Thriving, Disassociated Reverie. Is that how am I saying that? Is that the correct title?
Yeah, it's Thriving, a Disassociated Reverie.
Yeah. So here's the question: getting those awards for the audience, coming from the audience, what does that mean to you, getting those awards from multiple film festivals? From the audience.
I mean, it's absolutely incredible to have an award that comes from the audience. You know, I think, you know, so much of filmmaking is collaborative, and there's points in the process where you're working with other people and you're achieving the vision, but so much of it is kind of isolating, you know. You're making the work and you are trying to anticipate what you want an audience to feel from it and how it could resonate with them. But you're only ever anticipating that until your work actually gets out there into the world. And oftentimes you have to just ask yourself, does this resonate with me? Do I care about this? Does this excite me? And then hope that other people might feel the same way. So when your work actually finally makes its way to audiences and they actually embrace it and would give it such a legitimizing vote of approval that it actually is an audience award, it's incredible. I think it kind of shows that perhaps, you know, hopefully that I'm onto something as a filmmaker. It's very encouraging to have that kind of support as you continue in your career and make other projects and hope that other audiences will find them and also be excited. And I definitely feel that way about this one. I can't wait for this one to actually hit audiences at TIFF and beyond.
Andrea, how did the two of you originally meet? I guess back in 2011? How did the two of you meet?
Well, we met fortuitously on the set of a music video that Nicole was directing. I was recommended to play a go-go dancer on this music video. I'd heard a little bit about Nicole and I was really excited to meet her. And when I showed up, she was like, "Hi, I'm Nicole. I'm the director. And I will also be playing the other go-go dancer," because she hasn't shown up. So the two of us got ready together, getting dolled up and talking and connecting. And we really hit it off. And from there, a beautiful, collaborative, creative friendship was born, where from the very beginning, we've been collaborating with each other in some capacity. And so, yeah, that's the story. That's our meet cute.
Okay. So in 2022, he contacts you after reading your memoir, Modern Horror. In 2023, you work as a consultant on his upcoming screenplay, and you teach his leading actress essentially how to tap into her, I would say, her modern whore, how to be a stripper. In 2024, this film makes its Canadian premiere at TIFF, and in 2025, this film wins the Oscar for Best Film of the Year. Andrea, talk to me about your involvement in Anora. How did this come about for you?
Yeah, it's a pretty wild story. And it starts with a DM on Instagram. Sean Baker slid into my DMs. There's no other way to say it. He like sent me a message. A week prior, I had watched The Florida Project for the first time. And I love that film. And I love the way that it handled a sex work component to the film. And so it was very surreal to get a message from the director so soon after watching his work and having admired his work for a long time, and also being highly aware of his reputation among sex workers as someone who inspired sex workers to tell their own stories on film. So yeah, he had reached out and said that he was working on yet another film that dealt with sex work, and he had read Modern Whore. He'd also listened to the audiobook. He loved it, and was wondering if I did consultant work. And of course I said yes. There's no possible world where I was going to say no to that opportunity. And so for many months I worked with Sean, and just going back and forth on the script from its early stages into its later, more refined stages, to just sort of check the representation of sex work in the writing to ensure that it felt as authentic as possible. And so I was only involved in that script stage. And then, of course, I did also get the opportunity to talk to Mikey Madison before they went to set to film Anora about how she could tap into an inner archetype of, I don't want to say an inner archetype of whoredom, but essentially how she could tap into her own charisma and resilience and sense of humor in order to more authentically play a sex worker on screen. So that was a really like amazing conversation to have with her. And, you know, I didn't see the film until it premiered at TIFF last year, and I was blown away. And it was really exciting to see many of my recommendations on the screen. I was blown away by Mikey's performance. It's obviously an incredible film, and it's got all the accolades to show for it.
Were you surprised at the success of the film, especially when it comes to awards?
To be honest, not really. There's actually a really long history of sex worker films and women playing sex workers winning Oscars. So that actually doesn't surprise me that much. And it is an incredible film. And I could feel it, you know, as we were leading into TIFF last year, like, there's serious momentum here because it had also won the Palme d'Or at Cannes only a few months prior. So it definitely felt like something big was going on. And I mean, it's a beautiful, incredible, fun, fast-paced, engaging, dynamic film. And so, I can't say I'm totally surprised by its like big award sweep.
Here's my last question, and it's for the two of you, and Nicole, I'll start with yourself, but what do you hope audiences come away with after they've seen this very entertaining documentary, Modern Whore?
Yeah, I hope that, you know, it's going to depend on the audience member, but I hope that perhaps it resonates with them if they maybe have had sex work experience, and even if it doesn't resonate with them, you know, makes them feel like there's a shift hopefully happening where we can hear more stories and have, you know, yeah, all of the social and political change we want to see happen in terms of sex work. And, you know, and for those whom maybe this might be an introduction to the work, that they're going to come in with, you know, preconceived notions of what sex work and is and who sex workers are, I'm hoping that they come out with feeling like they have so much to think about and consider, but their main takeaway would be these are human beings and we need them to be supported in our society. They need rights. You know, and I think that the personal is political in this instance, and having Andrea's story hopefully told well is, I think, a part of that.
And Andrea?
Yeah, I would echo everything Nicole said. That's definitely what I hope audiences get from the film as well. You know, I do think that art has the potential and the capacity to transform hearts and minds. And I think that that's something that needs to happen with how people perceive sex work and sex workers. I hope that audiences leave the theater feeling more understanding and more empathetic and more aware of the fact that these are human beings who have been the victim of prejudices for thousands of years. And we deserve human rights. We deserve equal protection under the law. We deserve to be treated with respect and dignity and love. And I hope most of all that sex workers feel represented and they feel seen. And I hope that they feel inspired to tell their own stories. I really, really do hope that if they don't feel represented on screen, they're at least inspired to tell their own stories, because there are so many stories that have never been told, and each and every single sex worker story is important.
Well said, well said. Nicole Bazine, Andrea Warhan, thanks for your time. Well said, well done, well filmed, well made. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Mark. This has been wonderful.
Yes, thank you, Mark.
My name is Andrea Warhan. I'm a writer and performer, and I'm also a sex worker.
books, movies, and every syndicated crime drama imaginable, sex workers are typically portrayed as victims or villains. Shame and stigma can silence us. It's high time we told our own damn stories. Here's mine.
That was my spotlight on the Canadian films Bloodlines and Modern Horror. You can stream both films on YouTube as well as on Crave.
Bill 7, to ban discrimination in employment, government services, and housing based on a person's sexual orientation was up for a vote at Queen's Park. Most NDP and Liberal MPPs supported the bill, but without some progressive conservative legislators backing, a divisive split could rack the province. Four PCs decided to break party ranks to vote with their conscience and support Bill 7. Cabinet Minister and MPP Dennis Timbrell did it to show solidarity for his beloved brother, the well-known drag queen, Rusty Ryan. And for me, a gay politician who was not yet out, I had to take a stand. We were known as the Gang of Four. I'm former Cabinet Minister and MPP Phil Gillies. The date, December 2nd, 1986, when LGBT rights came to Ontario.
Hi, I'm singer-songwriter Steve Grand. You're listening to Rainbow Country with Mark Tara.
Taking us to hour two of Rainbow Country. The Canadian queer group, Genderfix, featuring Kate Ashley. Their track, Getaway Car.
Guys, gals, non-binary pals, different circles is moving. Same day, different time slot. We're now on Fridays at 9 p.m. Join